having a public hearing on House Bill 5041, the Department of Revenue. And we have invited testimony, starting off with the agency manager, Elizabeth Harchenko, with an agency overview, if I'm correct on this. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
I'm glad you didn't stand me up this morning.
No, sir. That would have been very bad form.
You stood us up yesterday, yeah, me.
Yeah. So, I have not yet learned how to be in three places at once.
Well, do we not have something in the in-service training component in the agency to help deal with that issue?
No, but I think we're going to do it.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. With me today is Susan Browning, the Deputy Director of the Department, and Jim Carboni, who is our analyst from Budget and Management Division. We have given you an agenda for the time that we have to spend with you, and I'm going to be very brief this morning, and then Susan will begin with the income tax programs. When we met with you in January, we went over what's the first few pages of the presentation document, the department's mission, which is to make the tax systems that you assign to us work so that public services are funded. We talked to you about our values and why we do things the way that we do them, which I think will come out in the conversation we have over the next couple of days. We reviewed the organization of the department. We have four operating divisions, our personal tax and compliance division, property tax division, business division, and administrative services division. We've divided up much of our work based on who the taxpayer is, and that's personal tax and compliance focuses on individual income taxpayers, and business division focuses on the taxes that are paid by business. Our property tax division is focused on the system of property taxation and partners with counties in administration of that tax system. And then our administrative services division is our internal support, technology, our finance organization, our processing center, and our human resources group. One of the things that you're going to hear about as we talk about programs is the balanced approach to tax administration that we take in the department. We work hard to try to assist those taxpayers who are trying to do what they're supposed to do by educating them and providing the best support we can so that they can meet their tax obligations. And when we need to use our enforcement tools, we use those as well. So you'll be hearing about that throughout. On page 6 in the presentation materials, we've identified the sort of high-level issues that we'll be talking about again in the context of each of these programs, our efforts to use continuous improvement and technology so that we're more efficient and we can provide better service to taxpayers. We have an issue around the funding of our tobacco enforcement and administration, which we'll be talking about a little bit more later this morning and on Thursday. And then the issue that's related to the funding of the counties that's been in the news at the federal level could have an impact on our property tax system, and we will be sharing with you some information about that. I did talk a little bit about the business partners that we work with from the federal level down to the local level. We work with the Internal Revenue Service, our peers around the country, and practitioners, and then local government for the property tax system. We'll talk a little bit more about those in the context of program. And we will also go over with you information about our business plan. We've been using a 4-year rolling business plan to plan our strategies, and particularly big investments in technology and continuing to improve the way that we administer our tax programs. So at this point, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Susan Browning. She's going to go over the income tax program materials. And then later this morning, Jack Ogami, who is the Business Division Administrator, will give you the high-level overview on tobacco and the business taxes that we administer. And then Wednesday and Thursday we'll be talking more about what we do and particularly the technology initiatives and policy option packages that we have. So,
thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm Susan Browning. I'm the Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue. Let's start on page 12. We're going to just give you an overview of the income tax programs, and this includes the personal income tax program and also the corporate income tax program. Page 12 gives you a picture of the general fund and where the money comes from. As you can see, about 88.5% actually comes from the personal income tax program, so that's one of our major focuses. Another 5% comes from corporate income tax, and all others about 6.3%, so that just gives you an idea of where the funding or general fund comes from. And as you move to page 13, that's the other side of the picture, where the money goes, the services that are paid for with Oregon income tax dollars. It's always surprising to taxpayers that more than half of the income tax dollars go to support education now. I think many people still have a connection with property tax, but right now half of all of the personal income tax dollars go towards education. Okay. And moving to page 14, this shows the administration of the personal income tax and corporation taxes and the department's role in that. You can see on the left-hand side the pieces that we administer. We do taxpayer assistance in education. Elizabeth touched upon that a little bit. We do processing and banking, and those of you who came on the tour yesterday had a chance to see that. We do auditing, collecting, and we do filing enforcement. And filing enforcement is identifying taxpayers who have not paid and determining what we think they owe and then working with them to file and pay that amount. So that's one of our bigger programs. As we mentioned before, $11.7 billion comes in through personal income and corporation taxes and 94% of the state's general fund. And our administrative costs are noted at the bottom, the FTE and the costs, and it's about 1% of our cost to revenue. Moving to page 15, and the income tax program is a voluntary program. We really rely on taxpayers to do what's right, to understand and accurately file and pay their taxes. And you can really see that, I think, on page 15. It shows how the dollars come in. About 72% actually comes through withholding taxes. So for wage earners who have withholding on their salaries, that's where the money comes into the department. Another little over 13% comes in as people pay with their returns. They didn't quite work their withholding out correctly, or they're self-employed or have other income, so they pay that way. Estimated tax is 13%. And the department's work really comes in with the 1.8% there, the audit and collections. The audit and collection work is important to get this money in. It's also very important to safeguard a voluntary system. It's important that taxpayers know that we are watching and we are taking responsibility for getting those dollars in. We're going to talk a little bit more about the balanced approach later with education, assistance, and enforcement. This is a view of how the money comes in through this process. On page 16, we have just some quick facts. I'm not going to run through all of these, but I just wanted to note a few of them for you. At the very top, it's important to us. The department received about 1.7 million returns in 2005, and 50% of those were filed electronically. That's been a really important piece to us as far as our efficiency and productivity. Mentioned before about filing enforcement, and there's a note down there about the fifth bullet, that we worked with 5,600 taxpayers for an additional 12,000 returns that hadn't been previously filed. And when we work with those taxpayers, we really put an emphasis on trying to make sure that they understand what they need to do and how to be responsible for that in the future, because we don't want to have repeat customers. This is not a program where you want to have people coming back into filing enforcement. So the taxpayers we contacted, 25% filed when we requested them to, 20% didn't have to file, and 55% of them we actually billed for their taxes and then work with them to collect that amount. On the corporation income tax, I want to just kind of note the third bullet on that. We audited about 1,000 cases in fiscal year 2005-06 and generated about $37.5 million in additional tax from corporations. corporation income tax is very different from the personal income tax. The much of the compliance corporation income tax does come from enforcement. I generally have much more sophisticated taxpayers who don't need the level of education and assistance as the individuals do. So a lot of our work in the corporation income tax has to do with auditing returns for accuracy and making sure that the taxpayers understand it, because it can be kind of complex, but also that they out-of-state corporations are following our income tax laws and working through that as well. So the enforcement with this program as well helps protect the integrity of the corporate income tax. That's that third pillar on our balanced approach. On page 17, we want to talk with you a little bit more about electronic filing and how it's growing. Again, I think you saw some of these pieces as we're going through here when you, if you were able to come on the tour. Electronic filing is going, we anticipate, that's the bar on the bottom. For tax year 2005, about 50% of the taxpayers file electronically, and that is growing. It's slowing down a little bit, but we expect electronic filing to be at about 1 million for 2006. So it is continuing to grow. What we call 2D barcode is also growing, remaining pretty stable. We estimate about 250,000 to 300,000 of the 2D barcode. And 2D barcode is, if you look at the, it's like more like what you have in a grocery scanner, grocery store scanner, that taxpayers are still able to file their return on paper. But if they use the right kind of software, it will generate a little barcode that has all their information in that barcode. When we get that paper return, we can just scan it, and all the information is entered. We don't have to key it all in. So it's really a time saver for us.
In the electronic filing for the average person out there who doesn't go to a tax preparer of one form or another, what are the difficulties for me as an individual to electronically file if I don't use a preparer, tax preparer?
Chair Jensen, there's several software options out there. We do post them on our website as well. Okay. And the vendors, I think, are becoming much more aware of keeping the product easy for individuals to use. Also, one of the things that we attribute to the growth is the strength of free filing. Do piggyback on the IRS so that you can file electronically your federal return and your state return. So
TurboTax is an example of one would have. I don't do my own, but that's okay.
Right. There are several major software vendors that have been out there, and they've been out there for a lot of years now, so they got the bugs pretty well worked out. This is really a great program because it has been in place for quite a few years now. You can see the growth from 2000, when we had about 330,000, up to this year we expect about 1 million. And as the software providers have worked with taxpayers, they've pretty much found out the problems people have and worked around those. So the people we talk to have been very pleased with it. The other piece about it that's really, really good is that if you're getting a refund and you do it direct deposit, you file electronically, do direct deposit, you could have your refund in your bank account probably within a week. So that's really a very attractive little carrot for people to use electronic filing.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're talking about the free filing, how really available is free filing? Most programs, there's a cost for doing that. And has the state ever considered just going to somehow a direct without some intermediary that actually is free?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, yes, we have, actually. The states, we work together. Elizabeth mentioned the business partners. The states work together pretty closely in this arena as well, and with the IRS. And there was some work several years ago, especially trying to, we worked on trying to just get our own free filing just so everyone could use it. Part of the piece about it is that the software vendors put a lot of time and energy into their product too, and they would prefer to provide a cheaper option for state filing to work through that piece of it. But that's an ongoing discussion. Free filing has expanded, and I think it may continue to expand. Elizabeth's been involved in some of those, too. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about it from the federal work.
There's been quite a bit of conversation, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, about what is the most appropriate way to make electronic filing available. And the compromise that's in place right now is the Free File Alliance, which is private software companies that have come together and agreed on standards. I think if people have income below $52,000, they're able to take advantage of one or more of the free filing programs that are available through the software vendors. But there's been a lot of contention at the federal level. The IRS has talked to the Congress about providing a direct filing option for taxpayers, which would probably be necessary for us to do that too, since we're so interconnected with the federal. We have not tried to have an independent standalone filing system for ourselves. And there are some members of Congress who think that that's really important, mm-hmm. that the IRS should provide a direct file, but the private sector is concerned about how far that goes, and they've argued that tax advice and tax planning is something that they should be providing and not the service, and so there's just a lot of kind of give and take at that level. There's a national advisory group that the Internal Revenue Service has formed that includes some folks from state tax agencies to try and work through some of those bigger policy issues with the Congress, but it's going to have to, for us, I think, because we've got such a strong connection into federal, and we've invested a lot in making sure that for taxpayers to be able to file both electronically, that we'll have to wait until the issue is resolved at the Internal Revenue Service level.
A quick follow-up. Well, I mean, as we heard yesterday, there is definitely a financial advantage to the state for people to do this, and I can't imagine it would be any different for the federal government. So it's something we need to keep working on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I think the issue at the federal level is to try to balance that, which it's highly desirable for any tax administrator to get as many returns in electronically as possible, simply because we then don't have to do manual data entry and we can provide much better customer service. The Congress is weighing that against the arguments about competition in an area that the private sector has typically provided the service. So it's one of those kinds of debates.
All right, page 18. Page 18 moves into the electronic payment. We were talking about electronic filing, and this is the electronic payment piece of it. And you can see that we've also had a growth in the dollars that come in through what we call electronic funds transfer. The department requires employers and corporations that have over a certain amount to actually pay through electronic funds transfer, and we follow the IRS's guidelines on that as well. So a lot of the money that the department receives is coming along through electronically, but this is from a smaller number of taxpayers. And you can see that when we move on to page 19, when we're looking at the number of documents we still receive. We still receive a lot of documents from people who owe smaller amounts. The electronic payments are coming in from the bigger employers, bigger corporations. That's why the dollars are large. But that, again, is a very, very efficient way to receive money. It's efficient for the department. It's efficient for the employers and corporations as well. On page 19, you see the number of payments processed, and we've termed this electronic payments versus manually processed. And manually processed payments would be checks and money orders and that type of thing, paper that's coming through. We still have the big dollars coming in electronically, but we still see a lot of paper coming in. And later, Don O'Meara and Elizabeth will be talking to you about our policy option package to help us work towards being more paperless in the year 2013. And this is part of it. This electronic payments piece is really, really a key piece. We'd like to have the money come in electronically and the returns come in electronically. Handling is very, very, manual handling is very, very expensive. On page 20, you can see the average days to deposit. And this really shows you the benefit of getting the money in electronically. The top piece, electronic funds transfer, $4.6 billion. That takes about one day to deposit. It's in and it's in the bank, and it's earning interest for the Treasury. A taxpayer sends in a check and a coupon with their taxes. It takes about 4 days to make it in the bank. If they just send us a check and maybe write at the bottom, or maybe don't write at the bottom, what it's for, then it takes up to about 6 days. And it can't take longer than that, depending on how they send it in. We get a lot of creative taxpayers. So this is where it takes the time down here. We're excited and happy to have the money, but it sure helps if we get it with a coupon. On page 21, we're shifting gears and talking more about the compliance aspect of the income tax programs. I was mentioned a little bit about pillars. And what we say our business is compliance for the income tax programs. And the three functions that we really need to emphasize are the education, assistance, and enforcement. And all of those are really, really important to have a good tax administration policy. On page 22, we'll talk a little bit about education. I'm just going to highlight some things on here. But education is really important to help make sure taxpayers know that they need to file and pay and have the tools to actually do that, so including new entrants into the workforce and lots of different people. The first bullet, we do provide a lot of information, our forms, our booklets, our publications on the web page, and that's the department's web page. That's where we've moved a lot of our information. And then the fourth bullet, we also work a lot with new businesses that are established within our local office areas to make sure that they understand what it's like to, now that they're now in business for themselves. We often hear, you know, businesses struggle more with the paperwork and the compliance with taxes and other regulations than they actually do with their business. So we really need to step up and help them understand their obligations in that area. And then the bottom bullet, I wanted to mention a little bit about that. We already talked about the software vendors, but we do partner and share information with business partners and try to help get information out in a coordinated way to people so that they understand it from the federal level and the state level. And compliance through education is one of our key strategies. On page 23, we're going to move over to the assistance piece. We try to provide assistance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I'm going to take us off in a slightly different direction, okay. Just keying off of something you said. When you talked about compliance through education, are there any other compliance mechanisms that you can effectively use? For example, posting delinquencies in a public place, other methodologies other than just outreach and education and the goodwill of filers?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we have the three pillars. Education is helping people, helping them understand what they need to do. Assistance is providing the tools, the information, the phone contact, the answering questions. And then when we get to enforcement, that's where we really work with taxpayers who are less willing and to step forward. That's where we get into the filing enforcement. We identify taxpayers who haven't paid, who haven't filed and haven't paid. We look at
follow-up. How do you identify them?
We share information with the IRS. We share information with other agencies. We have a whole staff of people who look for information. A lot of it does come from the IRS, but we also get leads and tips from people as well.
When do you share it with the public? I know of some states that have very widely publicized websites that have the names of all of the delinquent payers. I'm coming more and more to the theory that that's a good thing for people that pay their taxes and follow the rules. I guess I'm getting much less tolerant with those that don't, and I'm looking for some reaction from you guys. Maybe I should wait until we get to the enforcement piece.
Well, that's fine, Senator Johnson. What you're referring to is several states have posted the names of delinquent taxpayers on their websites. They post the person's name and then how much money they owe, and then it's out there for some period of time. We have looked at the Department of Revenue several times at that. The results are mixed on it. Some of the states really liked it and think it's a really good tool. Other states did it only one or two times and then became concerned about it and the philosophy of it. It is a voluntary system. It's a policy choice that's has some interesting feelings about it. Shaming people into complying with their taxes is what some states refer to it as, and they felt it didn't match what they wanted to do with their tax system. Other states were a little bit nervous about what if they accidentally get the wrong taxpayer out there. Are they subject to litigation and that type of thing? It's one that keeps coming up, and some states just love it and do it often. Others have done it and backed away from it. Elizabeth, do you want to share a little bit about it?
Well, I think Susan covered it. The issues for us have been around what are the agency values, how do we interact with taxpayers, and whether that particular tool is really going to have an impact for us. Many of the states that use that tool don't have a strong collection and filing enforcement parts in their program, and so rely on that as a different way of getting people to come forward and pay. So the concerns we've talked about in the agency have ranged from everything from if we have two taxpayers who have really similar names, and we get one up there and neighbors and friends of the other one start saying you didn't pay your taxes, to not updating correctly and timely so that we post someone's name and they've paid. So those kind of concerns about unfairly labeling people are out there, and the other is really pretty much more about the culture of our organization and our the importance of having a good long-term relationship with taxpayers. So it's a difficult one.
I guess I'm sympathetic to some of the comments you made. I lost my Chevron credit card because somewhere out there's an Elizabeth Johnson who had a bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And they snatched up my card, and fight as I could with them, I couldn't make the case that we were different people. So I'm sympathetic to that. Conversely, I'm getting less tolerant of the people that become scofflaws and fly in the face of those who file their taxes, follow the rules, do what they're supposed to do. And I guess my encouragement is not to create a culture inside the agency where it's okay not to pay because there are no public consequences to it. And having seen those lists from some other states, those are pretty provocative lists in terms of not wanting to be on the deadbeat list. And I'll be eager to hear how you think your enforcement piece causes there to be a higher collection than something that's a little more in your face to the people that are the scofflaws.
And we will talk a little
Senator
bit.
Senator Bates.
Oh.
I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
We will talk a little bit more about that, and I can share with you the enforcement tools we have, because the legislature in Oregon has given the department good tools and resources to work on filing enforcement. And I think we do make quite a big difference with the tools we have.
Chair, since good Senator started us on this conversation, I was going to kind of hold my questions until we got to that part of the presentation, but I'd like to give you a heads up where I'm looking at, where I'm going here. I'm concerned about what's going on in your audit departments.
Okay.
And the reason I'm concerned is I'm worried about aging of your workforce and turnover of your workforce.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also concerned about, like, sort of the black market economy in this state, which I think is significant. I don't think the IRS is going to help you with this. I'd like to have you give us an estimate somewhere along the line here in this presentation of how big you think that is. I've been in situations where I've had contractors brag to me, not knowing who I was, they haven't paid income taxes for 6 or 7 years, mm-hmm. the failure to the state, and they don't plan to. They're taking everything in cash, paying everything in cash, and staying under the radar while everybody else is paying their fair taxes for all the services they enjoy,
mm-hmm.
from roads to mm-hmm. hospitals to schools. And that's what I'm really interested in. Not so much the list that Senator Johnson's talking about is the ones you've caught, and that's important. I'm worried about the ones that are so far under the radar, you can't even identify.
Mm-hmm.
And I have concerns about what's going on in your audit departments from the point of view of turnover, mm-hmm. aging of your workforce, and number of auditors you have. You're taking some cuts in your agency here. I saw it in the LFO's evaluation, which I appreciate. I'd like to see where those cuts really occurred. Was it the audit departments? Was it the actual auditors lost? Was it supervisory personnel? Those are the kind of things I'd like to get a better feel for.
Certainly.
From my point of view, what I've seen, you know, and working with the state on these issues, I've never really had any serious complaints from any constituents about how you treated them that were law-abiding good people. That's done a great job. But I have people that I'm concerned about that are not being picked up. And I have concerned about how much work your auditors have to do, how well trained they are as they have more and more turnover, that experience you might be losing. So you can come back with that in a few days. I'd really appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, you bet. We wrote all those points back, and we will bring that information back to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was wondering also if I could ask you a question.
Certainly.
This is April, whatever it is, April 15th is coming up. Did you plan to remove this budget April 15th? Is that
it would be an excellent idea.
I just wonder if you were thinking that far ahead, and this is a sort of a...
Well, we were close on that track, but quite frankly, the date of April 15th is one that the chair does not look forward to.
Okay. I thought that was maybe a serendipitous, or you were planning this for us, you know.
I live in an environment that I believe in paying what I owe, but I don't believe in paying it until I have to pay it. And
just for full disclosure, I filed for an extension on Monday, so you guys. I did not have. I may have to do that.
You're gonna have to change these numbers.
Yeah. I set my quarterly in, okay, but I did file for an extension. I just couldn't get the laws up here.
Chair Jensen, Senator Bates, you do have a couple days. It's April 17th this year, so that gives a little bit of leeway.
This is not going to help. I'm feeling better already. I'm afraid I'm going to be up here, not down there, getting things done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Please proceed.
Okay. On page 23, we're moving to assistance. Assistance is providing help for taxpayers in a variety of ways, whether it's either by phone or in writing or personal contact in our field offices, or by email. We're getting more and more questions from taxpayers by way of the email, actually. Our goal is to respond to those in 24 hours. We do have 7 full-service field offices, and they're noted up above here: Bend, Medford, Salem, Gresham, Eugene, Portland, Tualatin. And we also have 3 satellite offices that are basically 1 or 2 persons that provide presence in Pendleton, North Bend, and Newport. So taxpayers can actually go in and bring their information and get their questions answered if they need to talk to people. Because we found that personal contact for some people is really important. They just really struggle with writing and phoning and emailing. For whatever reason, they need to sit across the desk from someone and talk about issues. So we have a variety of services that we provide that are outlined here. Okay. On page 24, this is the enforcement function. And we have 3 primary areas of enforcement. We have the collection activity, we have audits, and filing enforcement. And we do, as I mentioned, we do partner with a lot of other groups. We get information from the Employment Department, Board of Accountancy, tax practitioners, other state taxation departments with the IRS. We work with private collection agencies to help collect our debt as well. In the collection area, taxpayers can now pay in several ways. They can do credit cards and they can do payment plans. So we really encourage them to pay as much as they possibly can each month to get it resolved and get on with their lives and get it behind them. In auditing, our responsibility in auditing is to look for review tax returns for accuracy and to make certain that the taxpayers have reported everything that they should report. We do have an enhanced case selection program that we've developed that's helping us with our audit workload as well. And we participate with the Multi-State Tax Commission in auditing corporate income tax payers. Senator Johnson, Senator Bates sound like quite interested in filing enforcement. In the area of filing enforcement, we have a new non-filer enforcement tracking system that does allow us to access more data from more sources, including, I mentioned the IRS, but that is not all the data we get. We do get leads from people. We get information from the Employment Department. We're working with other state agencies in the area of independent contractors and ensuring independent contractors realize their obligation to pay income taxes, to treat their workers correctly and not just claim that they're independent contractors if they really are employers. So this has been kind of a controversial area over the years where some business owners have felt it more profitable for them to treat the people who work for them as independent contractors, when in reality, if you look at the statute and follow it through, those individuals are employees. And as employees, the employer has an obligation to do the withholding, an obligation to do the unemployment insurance, and the obligation to do the workers' compensation. So that's an area where we've been putting quite a bit of effort this biennium, working with the Employment Department, Workers' Compensation, Bureau of Labor and Industries.
I'll give you the first shot.
Okay. I guess I'm, when you said kind of controversial, that is, in my view, a horrific understatement. And it is my observation, and I'm looking for you to correct my erroneous thinking, that you guys are spending a lot more time, in some people's opinion, harassing folks about this issue than going after non-filers or this underground economy that Doc Bates talked about. I've had I'm aware of a case where a company ended up moving out of state because of the, in their view, difficulty in interpreting what the rules really were and the relentless interaction that they had with your agency and employment. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out where you've got obvious low-hanging fruit with non-filers. Why the agency decision to be as aggressive as you've been in the independent contractors?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the agency's efforts are really working towards right now trying to get the information out. We really are trying to focus on the education and assistance piece. We've got a new website that's joint with all the agencies. We're clarifying our roles and our responsibilities so that we can really partner and reduce the intrusion on the employer or the hiring entity and really improve that relationship to make it easier for the employer as well. This is just one area where we're spending time and energy. Really, the area of fraud enforcement, a lot of it deals with individuals and identifying those individuals who are self-employed or not reporting all of their income and determining, using access to a lot of information, what we believe their potential income is and what their taxes would be based on that. Then the process is to send them out an assessment that says, here's what you owe based on our best information, and then work with the taxpayer to get the taxpayer to come forward and work with us on it and accept responsibility for it and work through it. But if the taxpayer doesn't come forward voluntarily and work with us, we keep pursuing that. And we will keep working with the taxpayer to get payment on that.
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, I'd be curious to know whether or not you could produce for the committee a ratio between those companies that you are aggressively pursuing on the independent contractor question. I mean, it got so silly in the case that I was working with at one point as to the weight of the business card being an indice of true independent contractor status, versus those egregious deadbeats that are not paying you. I'd be curious to know how many of the ones that you're trying to determine an assessment you're dragging into court.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if my bias isn't just breathtakingly clear from my comments, going after the guys that are creating jobs and there may be a legitimate difference of opinion about the interpretation of the independent contractor, versus just non-filers or people that are engaged in a cash economy and, as Dr. Bates says, enjoying the benefits afforded to all the rest of us that pay. I just would be curious to know the ratio there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I need to address some of the comments that you're making because the legislature changed the standard for how you demonstrate whether you're an independent contractor, and business cards aren't an issue anymore. And they haven't been for a couple of years.
And that's fair, but in the case that you and I both know very well, it was, and I think it was ridiculous.
Well, the statute had that provision in it in the past. There is an inextricable connection between the non-filers and the independent contractor issue. Because if I'm a general contractor, and I am treating people who are working for me as independent contractors, and I'm paying them cash, and I'm not filing, and they're not filing. We're all non-filers. And it is in part related to this wink and a nod between the two parties that I'm going to treat you as an independent contractor. I'm going to pay you. You're going to be responsible for your own taxes. So it's all wrapped up in noncompliance. They aren't separate issues. They are very, very tightly tied.
Okay.
I think perhaps Director will not recall, but I called you on this very same topic, and I'm still not, from what we heard then, what I heard then, and what I'm hearing now, I'm still basically not satisfied with it. And the fact that two of us sitting on this committee, and I don't know about the others, but have had constituent problems with this particular area strikes me as there may be a lot more of these problems out there. I doubt that we have the misfortune of having only two businesses in the state who happen to have a representative and or senator who sits on this committee. I'm perplexed at this change in the statute. I'm perplexed as to whether when that was brought forward, it was brought forward by the department or whether it was brought forward by the legislature. I don't quite understand the logic of the state being far more restrictive than the federal government is on this, and especially in light of the fact that the federal government has another form of that they need to collect RE Social Security that they have been very worried about over the years. And so where did this statute change come from? Do you have a recall on that?
Mr. Chair, the statute change was developed by a task force that was created pursuant to state law 4 years ago.
Task force consisting
a legislative
of
task force. It was this. Perhaps what we could do instead of getting down sidetracked here is let me put some materials together for you and bring those back.
Please.
Either tomorrow or Thursday with a report of what's been done on independent contractor over the last several years.
Because I've been holding a priority bill to address this issue, and I would like to know more about it before I receive
it. We'll prepare a report for you and bring it in.
Thank you.
All right.
Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I apologize if this has been covered while I was out, but I would wonder if the Department of Revenue is comparing, like in contractors, their volume of income compared to their payroll, because I think that in particularly in residential housing, we're seeing a significant amount of labor that is being paid probably at under minimum wage in cash and not being deducted. I live in a community here in Salem where there's a lot of houses going up, and I wonder if the daily, looking at some of the ethnicity of the crews that are coming in doing various different things on those houses, about their legality and about how they're being paid. And I wonder if you're making any effort to compare the volume of a contractor's business to the boilerplate expectation of the amount of labor that he'd be paying.
If we may, Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, we're writing all this information down. Can we prepare some information and report back to you on that piece? Because you've got some really good questions here.
Thank you.
On page 25, we just presented some environmental factors and budget drivers for the income tax programs. One of the budget drivers I want to touch upon real briefly is the long-term health of the income tax system, and that's one of our main focus points on it. We want to to really invest our budget resources to do an accurate, effective job, and I think you'll see that as our focus on a lot of these projects. On page 26, we've got some budget issues we've noted. These are the four agencies' policy option packages for the income tax program. In the interest of time, I'm just going to talk about the refundable credit one. Electronic filing, document management, and payment processing. Don O'Meara and Elizabeth will be talking about that with you more when they get to their part of it. The refundable credit POP right now, policy option package, in the area of refundable credits, we pay quite a bit of attention to that because the credits are easily misunderstood by taxpayers. They find it difficult to claim and calculate the credits for these refundable credits. And what we're talking about for refundable credits are the mobile home relocation credit, the working family credit, and we now have the earned income credit as well. So that's kind of a different animal for the Department of Revenue. And we have, in addition to being easily misunderstood, people can get creative with these credits and claim credits that are not they're not entitled to or in amounts that they're not entitled to. So our goal is try to make sure the refunds get out very quickly to these deserving group, but to make sure they're also accurate, because we really need to safeguard the general fund revenue stream on that piece. We have diverted employees to do this work. We were not funded for this originally. We made the choice to do that because it's very important to the tax system. And our understanding is that the co-chairs have recommended that the policy option package initially had 12 FTE for this work. It was on page 79 of our budget book. These 12 FTE would be, we've outlined the benefits of what they would be doing on page 79. And with the policy option package, the intent was to release the employees that are currently helping on this back to their base work and get additional resources to work with the daycare providers and also the people who claim this work. But the
Senator Johnson.
I want to go back for just a second away from your policy option package and talk about the refundable credit.
Yes.
Particularly as you described it in relation to mobile home, I guess that's the best way to phrase it. I'm sure this is of interest to Representative Krummel, too, given his leadership on the issue of mobile home parks. And is it your observation that the mobile home credits are not well understood because of the applicability criteria, that some people who think that they live in a manufactured home just automatically qualify? What are the education pieces? Because I'm dealing with a constituent right now who is forced out of a mobile home park due to the closure of the park, has had just a whale of a hard time getting relocated someplace else, getting the mobile or the manufactured home moved, and then finds out that because of a poverty level threshold, she doesn't qualify, and considers the offer of the credit just a slap in the face given the plethora of other problems facing her right now. Tell me, if you would, what are the main issues surrounding that program or the public's lack of understanding, and what it is that you think you can do with respect to the policy option package to clarify it?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the mobile home relocation credit is different than the working family credit and the earned income credit because it targets a very small group, well, not very small, but a smaller population that is very needy and has these issues they're addressing. We've worked very closely with Representative Krummel in his office to identify issues that he's seeing coming up and why is the credit as it's written now in statute not working for those individuals. And we've identified a series of things. Part of it is the income piece, because right now the income threshold does include Social Security, for instance, and that's a problem for some people. They've just maybe just over the level for income, but most of their income's from Social Security.
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel very good to them. Some of it's, I think, a misperception that I'm not selling my mobile home, I'm staying here, so could I get a credit or can I get some? Because they are lower income individuals and they're very, very needy and very deserving. So I think that credit points out some of the real challenges with refundable credit, using this big tax system to get money to a specific group of people is challenging because some of the people, for instance, in Working Family Credit have not filed returns before, have not had a need to file returns before, so they haven't come in through the tax system. And the Mobile Home Credit people, a lot of them are elderly, low income, have a challenging time working through something pretty complex.
That's exactly the fact scenario that I'm dealing with because my constituent has never owed Oregon income tax, and in fact she states gets money back,
right,
and is now forced out of a home, tries to file for the credit, and realizes that the credit isn't available, and not only is she in the traumatic situation of being forced to move, now she finds out what little relief might be a possibility and held out as a possibility has just been pulled back, and the level of frustration is just off the chart.
It's very hard.
Mr. Chair, may I dive in here for a moment and see if I can shed any light on this? One of the things, the old saying of the road to hell is paved with good intentions. One of the things that we found from the legislation we passed in 2005 are there were some pitfalls that we didn't foresee. And I think that, over the course of the last couple of years, we've been kind of on this learning curve. We're just now finding out, because the tax credit didn't become actually applicable until January 1 of 2006, we're just now at the end of the first tax year. And I also want to commend the department for working with my staff and others to try to help people kind of navigate this and trying to get information out and that sort of thing. I think the biggest confusion point for people on the mobile home credit is the refundable piece versus the piece that is just a plain relocation credit. And the income levels that we put in the statute we thought were going to capture the people that really needed to have the help. One of the pieces that we didn't anticipate was what counts as income. So you might have a person in your constituent, Senator Johnson may very well be in this position, where they have maybe a small pension from, you know, wherever, some money that they stashed away. They've got their Social Security, and then they've got maybe a couple of other things. And then maybe there's another piece that somehow, you know, an inheritance that came in or something that else that came in, and now all of a sudden it has nudged them just over the top, and now they can't claim the tax credit. That's one of those, God, I wish we would have thought of that, sorts of things. And so in the new legislation that we've been working on this session, we've been trying to make sure that we rectify those so that we don't kind of catch people in that little bit of a gap. But it is the other issue that's a real question is that, people don't understand this notion that if they have no tax liability and they don't have to file a tax return, that now all of a sudden they can file a tax return and get money back from the state for money they've never put in. Well, I shouldn't say never put in, but they haven't put in recently, let's say, because in many of these cases were, of course, people that paid taxes for a gazillion years. So that's, I think, probably the biggest misunderstanding. And the other problem we had with that, and I'll be brief, Mr. Chair, is that we also had problems with public officials that didn't necessarily understand, and luckily not anybody from the legislature, but primarily one local government person that I can comes to mind immediately, that didn't understand this notion of a refundable tax credit and were making charges that this program would never help the people that needed it the most. So there is confusion out there. We've worked with the department on educational pieces. We have put a lot of information out. We've offered information to all the members of the legislature, and I know you've taken advantage of that, as have many others. And I think the biggest thing is to figure out where these pitfalls are and then try to correct them. Unfortunately, for people that are already sort of in the past tense, that may not be helpful to them.
Just to close the loop on this, I think my constituent's problem is too much income. Just as you said, when you piece together all of the sources of income, nudge just over the edge, and then faced also with the confusing, disorienting position of having to move from a closed park, find a place someplace else, go through the difficulty of moving a manufactured home. Mm-hmm. I think all of us have the idea that it's a lot easier than it is. And the compounding effect of them finding out that there isn't tax promised tax relief available was just enough to put her around the corner. Thank you for that explanation. It was very helpful.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I think that discussion really pointed out the issues with refundable credit. We have seen a really significant increase in our workload dealing with these credits, and the working family credit in particular, especially because of the volume of that. The initial policy option package asked for 12 positions to work with that. It would allow us to replace those employees that we've diverted to work on this, to send them back to more base work. It would also allow us to process the claims in a more timely manner, and also work with daycare providers, the public, and others to learn how to more accurately file the claims. And then we're also going to conduct audits of the daycare providers. My understanding is that the co-chairs budget approving 4 positions for this, and we're very thankful for that. Any resources will be real helpful in this area. The impact of the 4 positions, what we would continue to use, what we'd use those positions for would be to work on the timeliness of the claims. We expect in our policy option package performance measure, we said our intent was to take the measure from 120 days to process down to 90. With these 4 additional positions, we think we could take it from 120 days down to 110, so we could get them out more timely. We would also put some resource, one person, on working with the daycare providers and the other agencies and the tax preparers to explain how to do this so that taxpayers are more able to do it accurately and we can cut down some of this workload for the department. So we want to express our
Mr. Chair?
Representative Preble.
Thank you. May I clarify something? Susan, mentioned the 12 positions. Those are positions that are working with all of the refundable tax credit issues, and not just the mobile home, not just the working family credit, right, and so on. But in working the whole broad spectrum of refundable tax credits that are available, is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crumble, that's correct. That's all 3 of them, ones that we have now. The earned income credit that's coming on, just come on board, working family, and then the mobile home relocation. So all the refundable credit programs.
Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to move then to talk with you a little bit about the key performance measures. In the interest of time, I will just touch upon those real briefly. Talk about the ones that are related to the income tax program. We actually have 6 that are specific for the income tax program, and those are noted on page 27 for you. The first one is dollars collected per revenue agent per month. That really measures the productivity of our staff, and obviously revenue generation is one of our core functions. We've seen a pretty good increase in that as we've had more tools, for instance, like online payments and improved access to wage data. That's really helped our revenue agents be more productive. The next one is personal income tax assessments issued per employee per month. And this gets back to our discussion about filing enforcement, actually. It measures, marks the productivity of the staff who work to identify non-filing taxpayers and estimate the unpaid tax and then send out assessments. We are shifting our emphasis from sending out billings to encouraging taxpayers to file their own returns voluntarily. The staff, we really are encouraging them to help the taxpayer understand the importance of filing so that the person will get into compliance and stay into compliance, because we want to keep them in the taxpaying community. That's really important. It is linked to the next one, delinquent returns filed after compliance contact. So Key Performance Measure 5 and Key Performance Measure 7 are linked. We may be asking for changes also to Key Performance Measure 5 in the future. We have a new system that I mentioned, and we want to evaluate the effectiveness of the system on our productivity and also on how we can shift this focus more towards Key Performance Measure number 7. So we may be back asking for changes on that later. I mentioned 7 already, delinquent returns filed after compliance contact. with a filing enforcement employee. Basically, our strategy on that is once we identify the non-filing taxpayer, really encourage them to work with us to file their own return and send it in, and acknowledge they have responsibility. They do need to file. They need to file themselves. That they can't hide. They can't just stay out. They can't expect the department to hunt them down and work with them every time. They need to step up and do their part to be part of the taxpaying community. We feel if they voluntarily file their own returns, there's a lot higher likelihood of future tax compliance. And actually, we believe that's a very good strategy. The next one's number six. I jumped out of order and did five and seven because they're kind of closely linked. Number six is the personal income tax and corporation tax cases closed per revenue agent per month. And this is mostly personal income tax, to be honest with you about it. It does include the corporation tax program, but most of corporations' unpaid tax is paid pretty quickly. It comes about as a result of an audit, because the corporations step up and pay that pretty quickly. This really measures our speed in contacting a taxpayer and working to resolve the issue. We've had a lot of tools that have helped with this one as well. Online payments, where we go through a third-party vendor so people can use credit cards to pay their debts and work it through. And we're seeing a big increase in that. We also see have some tools in place that we think are going to help in the future, which one of them is direct debit. So that if taxpayers owe debt, they can actually have it taken out of their payment plan set up and take it out of their checking every month. So there's no excuse for not paying regularly on your payment plan. So that's going to be a big tool, we think. Average days to process a personal income tax return, that's key performance measure 8. And I think that's what a lot of people think about with the department. It's a very visible piece. It deals with the personal income tax program and how quickly we get returns, refunds out to taxpayers. It touches efficiency, it touches customer service, and also perception of the department and the state as a whole, because a lot of times taxpayers' involvement with the state a lot of times is through Department of Revenue. So it's important for us to get the money out into people's bank accounts as quickly as possible. We're doing very well this season. We mentioned about e-file and 2D barcode. That's really helped with those pieces as well. And speaking of those, key performance measure number 9 is the percent of personal income tax returns filed electronically, and that is going up. We really encourage e-filing back faster, more accurate, cheaper. Next piece we're going to be working on is e-filing for corporations. That's one of our future projects.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crumble.
Thank you. Susan, are you seeing a decrease in the non-compliance or non-filers because of the e-filing? In other words, they're finding it easier, so they're going ahead and sucking it up and filing like they're supposed to, or is that not really having any kind of an effect on the non-filers?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, I don't know that we've made that linkage between non-filing and electronic filing. The thing about non-filers is there's not one behavior in there. There's people who just procrastinate. They miss 1 year, and once you miss a year, it's harder to catch up, and you start getting a little scared of coming out. Those people are usually easy to bring back into compliance once we identify them. That sometimes it's a big relief for them. And so if electronic filing helps them to come forward and take care of their debts, that's the case. There are some people who just really don't want to file, and electronic filing wouldn't help them. So there's a whole gamut of behaviors there that we're trying to work with on it and meet people where they are and try to bring them back into the fold. And electronic filing could be a good tool. That's an interesting piece to look at.
Thank you.
Representative Galizia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do like the term non-filing taxpayer. That's a great oxymoron. The refund anticipation loans, is it accurate to say you have no way of really tracking those, the percentage? I mean, just because it's just going to come to you as a return that's filed. Is that accurate?
Jensen, Representative Galizia, that's correct. That really doesn't involve the department as such. I know there's been concern about those, but we don't get involved with that piece of it. I want to touch just real quickly on the department-wide measures, too, key measures. These apply to the income tax programs and the property tax and tobacco and all of the programs. Taxpayer assistance contacts, that's our tax We evaluate how well we're helping taxpayers through our web and the phone. One of the key things we did was we launched our website that has Where's My Refund? And that really cut down the number of calls, because people at 2 in the morning can check online to see where the refund is and not call us constantly. They can check the website constantly. So that was a big, big plus. We're also working on replacing our interactive voice response system now, too, and that'll help us be more efficient. We may be changing the data on this one because the Department of Administrative Services is now administering our website, and they track the data a little bit differently than we do. So the concept hasn't changed, the function hasn't changed, but the tracking, the numbers are going to change. So we'll be getting back to you on that one. Employee work environment. That impacts all the department programs as well, and it tracks how well we're doing with the physical environment, support for employees, resources. And we survey our employees to see how they feel about the work environment. We have had some issues over the years about physical environment, and I think we're finally getting to the point where we're providing adequate space and furniture for our employees. We had them crammed in pretty tightly with pretty old furniture, and that was causing a lot of problems for people, and it's hard to do a good job when you don't have the tools to do it with. Employee training per year, that's KPM number 11. That's all department programs. That actually ties in with state benchmark 29. That measures the percent of Oregonians in the labor force who have at least 20 hours of skill training in a year. We really struggled with this one through the budget constraints. Training, unfortunately, has been an area where it's hard to keep it up, the formal training. But we've really still continued to focus on more on-the-job training, like work out of class opportunities or developmental opportunities. And the final one.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Jensen.
Oh, go ahead. The final one.
Okay, final one. The final one is the standard one, the customer service one that the state agencies are asked to do now, or the percent of customers rating satisfaction with the agency's services good or excellent.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I'm struggling, frankly, with the first three of these department-wide measures. The number four would appear to me to be an output, and 10 and 11 would appear to be inputs, not outcomes. I understand that the employee environment is important and employee training is important, but that is that's what you do to get to the outcome, not it isn't an outcome in itself, in my mind.
Got it.
Senator, Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, we are continuing to look at these measures, and we will certainly take that into account and try to work on these better. Number four, I think does need some help. It measures our work with our website and our phone. We are struggling with this one to see get a better measure for it, and we keep working with that one as well. 10 and 11, our employees are very, very important to us, and we feel it's important to have this as a measure to judge how well we're supporting them with training and with their work environment and their resources, because the Department of Revenue is primarily personal services. All we have primarily are our people, and it's really important that our people have the resources they need to do the job well and the training to do the job well. So,
hello.
Yes, I would take Chair Jensen. I wouldn't argue that they're important inputs. I mean, employees are the backbone of every agency and of every business, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see them as an outcome.
We'll let you meditate on that
Please.
Before we get to a little
Thank
bit
you,
later,
Chairman.
And we want to move on to figure out how we're going to get all this tobacco tax money.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Crumbles.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just one very quick comment on number four, maybe adding something to the effect of taxpayer assistance contacts resolved satisfactorily within 30 days, or, you know, pick your number here.
Okay.
That would be providing you with an outcome as to when you've been in contact. It doesn't matter whether it's department-generated or taxpayer-generated.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, thank you for that and that comment. And Senator Whitson, that's a good thought. Okay. And number 12, mentioned that one a little bit. And that's this primarily measures the personal income tax and the services in our field offices and with tax services unit. It's a survey. We found that primarily our taxpayers are satisfied, but we do want to continue looking at this one as well. We are also proposing or looking into the concept of having an additional new key performance measure in the future, percent of dollars banked within one business day, because we think that's very important measurement for the department. So that is the income tax program piece.
Thank you. We'll move on then to Jack Ogemi. Tommy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Good morning, Jack.
My name is Jack Ogemi. I'm the Business Division Administrator at the Department of Revenue. And this morning I'm here to provide a high-level overview of the other taxes and services administered by the Department of Revenue. And the major tax in that category is our tobacco taxes. I'm hoping that the information that I provide today sets a good foundation for the more substantive discussion that we have planned on continued funding for the Tobacco Compliance Task Force that I understand we're going to be having on Thursday. So I'm going to be trying to set the foundation for that. On page 30 in your binder, you could see that tobacco taxes generate over $500 million in revenue for the state of Oregon, and the primary beneficiaries of those funds are the Oregon Health Plan, the General Fund, along with county and cities and smoking cessation programs. The state's cost of administering those programs is projected to be approximately $5.4 million next biennium. And the Department of Revenue provides general support functions to support this, the tobacco tax programs. And those general support functions are banking money, processing returns, licensing distributors, and managing the inventory of cigarette tax stamps. And these services are provided primarily for those people who choose to voluntarily comply with our tax laws. For those who choose not to comply with our tax laws, the 2001 legislature created the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, which are the Oregon State Police, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Revenue. And the Department of Revenue's role on that task force is to promote voluntary compliance in the retail distribution network by auditing distributors and performing retail compliance inspections to make sure the retailers are complying with our tax laws. The Oregon State Police and the Department of Justice, their role on the task force are to perform criminal investigations, criminal indictments, and seek criminal prosecution for those who are involved in criminal-type behavior. When I talk about Oregon's tobacco taxes, there's actually two taxes. The first and the largest is the tax on cigarettes, which is $1.18 per pack of 20. The cigarette tax is collected through the sale of cigarette tax stamps to distributors. The presence of a tax stamp on a pack of cigarettes at the retail store can very easily and visually verify that the tax has been paid on that pack of cigarettes. We generate about $470 million per biennium for the state through the cigarette tax program. The tax on all other tobacco products, such as cigar and chew and roll your own, is known as the other tobacco products tax. And licensed OTP distributors, they obtain their license through the Department of Revenue, they're authorized to buy untaxed product directly from the manufacturer or from out-of-state sellers of other tobacco products. And quarterly, they prepare a return where they self-assess a tax based on 65% of the wholesale value of the product that they've brought into the state. The problem with the way it's set up right now is that the other tobacco products, once it hits the retail store, there is no evidence on that product that the tax has been paid. So our technique that we use to validate compliance is we have to go back and use auditors to go and audit the distributors to make sure that the tax has been paid. One of the things that we're finding from our Tobacco Compliance Task Force is that there is substantial noncompliance in the area of other tobacco products. That's where we're finding most of our problems.
Chair, may I ask a question about that?
Representative Crummell.
Thank you. Jack, if a purchaser bought off the Internet, ordered from some out-of-state person and they ordered cigars, for example. And they said, you know, I want to be honest about this and I want to pay my tax, but I have no way of validating that the tax has been paid. Assuming that they're paying a retail value for the product, how would they figure out what the tax on that would be, because the tax is based on the wholesale value? So if a person bought a box of cigars that were, you know, they bought for $100,
mm-hmm.
I can do the math that way, how would they figure out what the wholesale value of that product is, so that then they could make a report to the state that they owe, you know, $8.47 or whatever it is in tax, and actually remit that to the state?
My understanding, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, my understanding in talking to the program manager is that the wholesale value of the product is actually the value of the product when it crossed the state lines into Oregon. And so the person that's bringing the product into Oregon is whatever the price of the product when it comes into the state of Oregon is actually the wholesale value of the product coming in. So that's the price that they've been recommending to taxpayers to use to pay the tax on, because the tax is on the person that brings, is the liability of the person that brings the product into the state.
That $100 box of cigars could be pretty hefty in terms of tax then, if it was a... Okay.
That's why you get such a good deal over the Internet.
Representative Belize.
Yeah.
Piss off your education
fund. Yeah, that's right. Community College OTP fund.
Yeah.
The Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force that's been around for 6 years...
Yes, sir.
Is it under their... Let me rephrase that. Have they ever suggested to the legislature that particular changes are made vis-a-vis other tobacco products, or are there things that could be done, changed in statute, that would make compliance higher?
One of the things that the task force has done is that they're a member of the Western States Tax Administrators Association, and they formed a work group looking at alternatives to stamping or placing some sort of indicia on other tobacco products to evidence that tax has been paid, stamping or some sort of a laser mark. So that's one of the things that the Western states are looking at right now. One of the challenges is that the product historically has not been labeled. So in order to get an effective stamp, you'd want a large region, say like the Western states, to be using the same type of labeling or stamping device, so that it wouldn't be different for every state.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Chair Jensen, a couple of questions, Jack. One on your other tobacco tax. You're running about 65% of the wholesale prices and taxes.
Yes, sir.
With the cigarette tax at $1.18, what is that percentage of the either the wholesale or retail price at $2.02, which is adding 84 cents? What would be the percentage? And then, do you have an opinion on what adding 84 cents to the tax on a pack of cigarettes would do to our revenue stream and also to the sale of cigarettes?
Well, as far as the opinion, I don't have enough knowledge to answer that question as to what an 84.5 cent increase would do to the revenue stream. I think we've relied on the Legislative Revenue Office to make those types of estimations. As far as the percentage increase, I'm sorry, I don't have what the wholesale price of cigarettes is. I can find that out and have that back on Thursday.
Thank you.
For that calculation.
Bob
Dallas?
Yes.
What does legislative revenue come up with on that, you know?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Elizabeth to to weigh in on this. There's a number in the governor's budget on the 84%, the 84-cent tax increase, and we had discussions about this, and the number escapes me. Do you remember, Elizabeth?
We need Mazen. Mazen Malik.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the number, the assumption that's in the governor's budget is $180 million. If the tax was raised to 84.5 cents, and if the other tobacco products tax went up to 95% of wholesale, and if those were both effective October 1 of 2007, that would be what would be produced for this upcoming biennium. That's the proposal that's connected with House Bill 2201. The Legislative Revenue Office estimates were very, very consistent with those numbers, and they did quite a lot of analysis about the change in consumption and cross-border purchasing of cigarettes by folks from Washington State who currently come into Oregon because our tax is lower. So that consumption change is factored into the revenue estimate, but I think they were like $182 million for 2007 and 2009 on 2201.
Okay. Well, on page 34, tax verification. That's the other tobacco products problem where it's very difficult to prove the tax has been paid. One of the other environmental factors that's out there with our tobacco programs is that the state of Oregon has agreements with 7 of the 10 federally recognized tribes where they sell Oregon stamp cigarettes on the reservation. So we avoid many of the problems that you read about in the newspaper that Washington and Idaho and the state of New York are having because they don't have agreements with their tribes and they're often in conflict with each other. Budget drivers, our key budget issues for the tobacco tax programs are summarized in our policy option packages. The first policy option package that is really significant is the continuation of the funding for the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. And we're expecting to have a good discussion about that on Thursday. Our other policy option package asked for continuation of funding that we originally received from the June 2006 e-board to bill and collect for internet purchases of untaxed cigarettes to individuals. And our third policy option package requests funding to implement the proposed increase in tobacco taxes to fund the Healthy Kids Initiative. On page 35, we have the key performance measures for the Tobacco Task Force, and the partners agreed that our performance measure is going to be the amount of tax avoidance identified through task force efforts that resulted in some enforcement action by the task force expressed as a dollar value. This means what we're going to be measuring is how effective our enforcement actions have been based on the dollars that we identify in unpaid tax in our auditing and in the criminal prosecution. Are you ready to move on to other taxes and services?
I think we're probably about at the end of the hour here. Maybe that's a convenient breakpoint. I just had a quick question. The Department of Revenue has no input into the education. You simply provide the money. You're a flow-through for the money for education.
Mr. Chair, yes. We collect the income tax dollars, pay those into the Treasury where they go into the general fund.
And somebody else spends.
And then, somebody else spends. That would be you.
Yeah, I understand. my question or concern with that is I'm not sure that we're targeting the right audience with our education, but it's not a question for this department, so we'll we've got enough to trouble you with. Yes.
Jackson, Jack, I was wondering if you could expand a little on the relationship with the tribes. You said the state of Oregon has signed agreements with 7 of the 10 federally recognized tribes. Signing that agreement would seem to remove the tribe's competitive advantage in sales. So how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding as to how the agreements work is that they sell Oregon-stamped cigarettes on the tribe or on the reservation, and what they get back is they get a refund back based on the there's a formula they go through to rebate back to the tribes the estimated value in Oregon tobacco taxes that would have been paid by tribe members who consume cigarettes.
Is that clear? What?
I'm still working on that.
Mr. Chair, what the legislature authorized many years ago, authorized the department to engage in cigarette tax refund agreements with the tribes, so that we wouldn't have the battle of tribes selling untaxed cigarettes on reservation land. And so that what the tribes do is they buy their cigarettes through the same distribution systems that anybody else does, sell the tax cigarettes, and then we have an agreement with them based on the number of their tribal members and the percentage of those people based on information we have about the percentage of the population that smokes, and estimate for them the volume of the cigarette sales that they are making that are likely to their own members. Those cigarette sales shouldn't be taxed, and the statute allows us to then rebate to them that deemed amount of tax. So they have a regular stream of revenue that comes to them that is that portion of the tax that is most likely being paid by their own members on cigarettes that their own members are buying from them. But for any cigarettes they're selling to anybody else, they are collecting the tax for us, and that's being reflected in the price that they're charging, and that revenue has come to us through the distributor having purchased stamps. So it's a win-win relationship. The tribe doesn't have an economic incentive to sell untaxed cigarettes. And then we don't have some of the battles that some of our neighboring states have had with untaxed cigarettes being sold on tribal land to non-tribal members.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, one quick question. Is that also applicable on other tobacco products?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, I don't know the answer to that question. We'll get it. I think the agreements are about cigarette tax. I don't think they're about OTP, but we will check.
Thank you.
Okay, we will see you again tomorrow morning. Same time, same station. We're adjourned.